Well, hello, everyone. It's a real honor to be invited to talk before the 1,200 most important Democrats in America. And I will say, this is, and of course, I've been to many state dinners in Pennsylvania and throughout the country during my time as Democratic chair in 2000. And this is an unusual dinner. Unusual because you have a tremendous tolerance for speeches. But also unusual because you've had one great speech after another tonight, right? You know, Senator Harkin and I were just talking right before Chet got up to speak. And his speech, Senator Harkin's speech, reminded me of something. And I want to do a little audience participation here. I know you had raffles and stuff, but this is for free. If you get this question right, I will give you two tickets to the next Cubs World Series game. Oh, ye of little faith. Who gave the nominating speech, and Tom, this is going to mark us as really old here. Who gave the nominating speech for Adlai Stevenson at the 1960 Democratic Convention in Los Angeles? No, she gave a seconding speech. That's very good. It's very good. I don't know if you'll make it to the Cubs World Series, though. No, it wasn't Humphrey, but close. It was Eugene McCarthy. Gene McCarthy. And Gene McCarthy spoke about Adlai Stevenson, and it set off a tremendous demonstration that had the Kennedy folks worried that Stevenson was going to run the convention. And he said that Adlai Stevenson had made us all proud to be called Democrats. And I was a teenager back then, but my dad, who died when I was 14, he never was in politics. He was a converter in the garment industry in New York, but he loved the Democratic Party. He loved FDR, and he loved Adlai Stevenson. And we, literally, when I was 8 years old in 52, we banged up signs for Stevenson all over Manhattan. And the only time I ever saw my dad cry during the 14 years that we spent together was the night that Stevenson lost to Eisenhower. There was no TV then, no polls. We didn't know how the election was going to come out. We went to the supermarket that was open late, and while we were checking out on the radio, it said that Eisenhower had carried enough states to be declared the next president. And as we walked the 2.5 blocks home, I saw my dad, who was a big, strong, proud man, with tears streaming down his eyes. And it is true, Adlai Stevenson did make us proud to be called Democrats, but so does Tom Harkin. And it's my belief that Tom Harkin will go down as one of the greatest senators to ever serve in the United States Senate. But just like Chet said, we ain't stopping. There's a lot of work to be done. And if we're going to bring this country where it needs to be, we need Tom Harkin in the United States Senate. Now, I do know, I'm in my 8th year as governor of Pennsylvania, I do know a little bit about what it takes to be a good governor. And I don't think I have to convince the people in this room, you've got a good governor. The only thing I'd say about Chet is, I wish he were a little bit more enthusiastic. Listen to, you know, Chet is like a lot of us. I guess I don't suffer from this too much, but he doesn't like to talk about his own accomplishments as much as I think he should. He talked about Iowa being named the third best-run state in the country, but he didn't mention something that you all probably know, but I don't know how many Iowans know it, that Iowa's unemployment rate is 30% below the national average. That your revenue estimating conference says that the state is running $300 million ahead of estimates in revenue. A fact that you don't know, and something that Pennsylvania and Iowa share proudly, there are five states who were named by congressional oversight committees as the best in the nation. Number one, we shared number one in effectively spending and using the stimulus money for road and bridge transportation. And Chet and I this afternoon did a press conference in the Southeast Connector here in Des Moines, and it highlighted the great iJobs program. At a time when we need to create well-paying jobs that can't be outsourced, at a time when our infrastructure is challenged everywhere, and particularly in states that have had flood damage, what a great idea to have the courage to borrow $800 million and use it to leverage investments that are changing the face of Iowa, that are fixing our levees, that are doing things that make a huge difference and are creating tens of thousands of great jobs. So, Chet Culver deserves to be reelected as governor for the things he's done. For a moment, don't worry about the other guy. He deserves to be reelected. An incumbent deserves to be reelected if he's done a good job. Chet Culver has done a very good job. But I do want to say a word about his opponent. Just because, as Chet knows, this is an area, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later, this is an area that's very important to me, education. And the foundation to successful public education comes from early childhood learning. We know that our children start learning maybe as early as 6 months. And it is essential for us to have good, robust, totally available pre-K programs. In a year when there are some of the worst and craziest ideas put forward by Republican candidates, perhaps the worst in the country is cutting pre-K here in Iowa. Do you know, there is study after study after study that shows for every $1 we spend on pre-K, we save $6 or $7 on social costs, on criminal justice costs. But even if it didn't save any money, if government's not about giving children opportunity, giving them pathways to success, then what are we here for? What are we here for? And to think that's the way we're going to cut the budget. That's going to be a part of a plan. Dumb idea. Dumb and dumber. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit tonight. And I said to Tom, I said, the problem with being the last speaker is that so much has already been said. And your speakers were so good that they said it so well that I'm going to try to shorten this a little bit. But I think this is, you know, politicians are always saying this is the most important election of our lifetime. You hear that every cycle. But this is an important election. I think this election and the election in 2012 will go a long way towards determining what type of country we're going to have. There's some fundamental divides in the visions of what type of America we're going to have. There's one vision that says we continue to invest in our own growth, that we continue to invest in American competitiveness, that we invest in the basic core job of protecting our most vulnerable citizens, the old and the young, the disabled, and that we invest in creating a pathway of opportunity for every, and I mean every American, so every American citizen can reach their full potential and get part of the American dream. But then there's another vision, and that vision says that government should stop investing, that government shouldn't worry about promoting American growth or American competitiveness, that government should stop spending money on protecting its own citizens. And worst of all, and most dangerous of all, that vision says that we turn our back on the age-old American tradition that we take care of each other, that we are a nation that's inclusive and diverse. That vision would take some people and elevate them above the rest of us. Those are two competing visions. And which way we go as a country will decide, in my judgment, whether America remains a great economic power, but more importantly, whether America remains a great country, a country with soul, a country with caring, a country that has meaning for its people. We've got to win those fights. You know, they say government's the enemy. They say government can't do anything right. They say we want smaller government or no government. We say government surely can't solve all of our problems, but it can be an important catalyst to promote growth, to promote opportunity, that it's an important catalyst in protecting people and making sure that we stand together as one nation. You know, I was on one of the Sunday shows, I think it was ABC one day, in January, late January, and the moderator showed me a clip of Mike Pence. Mike Pence is the ranking member of the House Budget Committee, and I don't know if our congressmen are still here. They showed Mike Pence addressing the CCAP convention in Washington. That's the conservative convention. And he was saying, yes, we're the party of no. We say no to taxation, no to spending, no to borrowing. And the clip ended, and the moderator turned to me and said, Governor, what do you think of that? I said, it's a prescription for disaster for this country. If we stop investing in ourselves, we're cooked. Well, Fox News, never one to avoid controversy, they asked Congressman Pence and I to come on the show, a show together. And I said yes, and after about a week, Congressman Pence said yes. And we came on the show, and he spoke first, and he gave the same rant about no borrowing, no spending, no this, no that. And it came my time to speak, and I said, Congressman, you seem like a reasonable man. Now, in fact, he didn't seem like a reasonable man to me. But when you're on those shows, you want to seem like you're a reasonable guy. I said, Congressman, you seem like a reasonable man. Tell the people watching us today, if we don't spend money, if we don't invest, if we don't invest, how are we going to make sure that our roads, our bridges, our dams, and our levees are safe? How are we going to make sure that we don't have accidents like we've seen all over this country? And of course, there's no answer to that. If you buy a car and spend a lot of money buying the car, if you don't maintain it every year, if you don't put money into maintaining it and keeping it working, it breaks down. And Congressman Pence looked a little stunned, and then he did, I guess, the best he could. He said, there you Democrats go again, using the word investment when you really mean spending. That was his answer. That was his answer. And folks, there is no answer. We know that there's good government spending, targeted, effective, implemented well. And there's bad government spending, wasteful, not directed to things that really matter. And the key for us as a country is not to have the government stop spending, but to have it spend wisely, to make sure that spending is effective. Now, you know, you may be shocked by this Republican assault on the government. You may say, boy, this is just extraordinary. Government's bad, government's this, stop doing that. It's nothing new. Back in 1961, Ronald Reagan said Medicare was a step towards socialism. And he made this unbelievable quote, which I want to read to you. He said, if Medicare is not stopped, one of these days you and I are going to spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like to live in America where men were free. That's what he said about Medicare. The first President Bush, 3 years later, said that Medicare was the equivalent of socialized medicine. Social Security, which is now politicians from both parties fall all over themselves talking about Social Security and we're going to protect Social Security. Well, back when Social Security was being debated, a congressman, a Republican congressman, said that with Social Security, Americans would come to feel the lash of the dictator. Folks, I'm not making this stuff up. Another Republican senator said Social Security would mark the end of progress for a great country. And a Republican congressman topped it all by saying Social Security was part of an insidious plot designed to enslave workers. Any of this ring a bell? Death panels? They've been talking about government programs for years and years, for decades. And they've been trying to run down programs that are aimed at helping people, and they've been wrong every single time. Now, we say that government programs, government spending, again, if they're targeted right and if they're implemented effectively, can make a difference. And the reason I was so upset hearing about what Chet's opponent said about pre-K is because education has been a very special thing for me as governor. My first year as governor, I inherited a $2.4 billion budget deficit. I had 5 weeks to prepare our budget, and I knew I had to raise taxes. There was no other alternative. I knew we could save money eventually, but I couldn't do it in 5 weeks. So I thought Pennsylvania should end the shameful situation where we were one of 9 states that didn't give one dime to pre-kindergarten. So I put in $500 million in the budget for early childhood learning, pre-K, full-day kindergarten, smaller class sizes, after-school tutoring. And you know what? The Republicans wouldn't budge. We're supposed to have a budget by July 1st. My first year, we didn't have a budget till December 21st. Created havoc for our school districts. But I wasn't going to budge, and finally we compromised and got $300 million for early childhood programs. And that began a chain of events. Pennsylvania now spends $4 billion a year more on public education than it did before I became governor. And the results have been nothing short of incredible. We have 41% more of our students proficient in reading and math than we did 8 years ago. 41% more. According to the Education Research Council, we are the only state in the union, sorry, Chet, the only state in the union to, on the national test, to have made substantial progress at every grade level tested and in every subject matter tested. And a key component, all of this was cumulative, but a key component was we didn't tutor any kids after school before I became governor. We now tutor nearly 100,000, mostly in the younger grades, but some 8th and 9th graders too. And in that first year, tutoring was in my budget, but since we didn't get the budget passed till December 21st, the schools that had hoped to implement it in the January semester couldn't do it. The money wasn't going to get there in time. But there was one school in suburban Pittsburgh that the teachers got together and said, yeah, we know we're not going to get the money this year, but we'll volunteer this semester to tutor after school. And they did. When September rolled around and the money started to flow, the school district had a big celebration to thank those teachers who had volunteered. And they asked me to come out. And I did. There were about 300 people, 3 or 4 TV cameras. Superintendent spoke, principal spoke, teacher spoke, parent spoke, I spoke. And then they asked one of the students who had been tutored to speak. He was a 6th grader. He had been a 5th grader in January. And he was introduced and he came up to the podium. He was a big kid. He was about 6 feet, heavy set, sort of awkward and oafish. And he got up to the microphone and he froze. Didn't say anything. 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 50 seconds. As it approached a minute, I began to get up out of my chair. I was going to say something to him to encourage him. I was just sitting right behind him. But as I was getting up, I saw him sort of gather himself from his heels, and he approached the podium, and his shoulders were sloping down. And he looked down like this, and finally he spoke into the microphone. He said, "Last year, I was stupid." And he stopped speaking again. And this time, it was about 20 seconds. And he backed up from the podium, and then he strode back to the podium, and when he came back the second time, his shoulders were straight, his chest was out, and he said, "But Mrs. Parker," and he pointed to his teacher. He said, "Mrs. Parker worked with me and five other kids 4 days a week for an hour and a half after school. And now I'm not stupid anymore." And when he said that, I first thought about Mrs. Parker. It's true, nowhere in this country do we pay our teachers enough. Working conditions aren't good. Teachers are the butt of a lot of criticism that they don't deserve. But I thought that one student, with that one remark, made it all worthwhile for Mrs. Parker. Because understand, folks, that young boy was headed, without tutoring, without Mrs. Parker, that young boy was headed to fall further and further behind. He was behind in reading and math. He was going to fall further and further behind and would have dropped out by the 9th or 10th grade, and he would have been DOA on the job market, DOA in terms of having a decent, fruitful life. That young man thought he was stupid and had no hope. But because of Mrs. Parker, because of the tutoring program, that young man who got up there with his shoulders straight and his body language totally different, that young man thought that there wasn't anything in the world he couldn't accomplish. Now, like the rest of us, he'll learn that's not so. But he's headed to a great life. He's headed to doing something meaningful. He's headed to self-value and self-worth and self-esteem. And sure, Mrs. Parker gave it to him, but so did government spending. Because it's a great program. And we're going to stand by and let people like Chet's opponent cut $100 million out of programs like that. Not on Chet's watch and not on any of our watches. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about this election, too. We've got 16 days to go, and everyone's told you, you've got to get out there and talk to a lot of people. And you do. And what I'm about to say now, I don't know enough about Iowa to know if you are guilty of doing or not doing some of the things I'm going to talk about. So don't take it personally. But I want to say this about the election and about us. First of all, we have to follow the lead of our president, who I think in the last 2 weeks has done a great job out there, a great job out there, talking to Democrats, talking to independents who haven't made up their mind, and talking to some moderate Republicans. And we've got to continue to remind our voters, hey, you may be disappointed in the way things are going in the country. You may be disappointed in the president. In Pennsylvania, they may be disappointed in some of the things that I've done. But this isn't a referendum. It's a choice. It's a choice. You've got to choose. It's not a yes, no. It's a choice. And you have to choose between what we're offering and what they're offering. And think about what they're offering. Anybody here, I'll also throw in two tickets to the next Cubs World Series game. If anybody here can honestly say that they read every page of the Pledge for America that they released. Did anybody read every page? Tom, not you? Well, I did. But I have to preface that by saying I have no life. I mean, I'm here and the Phillies are playing in Philadelphia, game one of the National League Championship Series, so you know I have no life. The Pledge for America is a fraud. Basically, first of all, it says it's going to cut the deficit. Every economist who's looked at it said it will cause the deficit to go up $11 trillion in the next 10 years. But worse than that, it basically says we're going to go back to everything we did when George Bush was president. I mean, think about that. Think about that. We're going back to the policies that put us at the brink of economic disaster. It makes no bloody sense. And it's a choice, folks. It's not a referendum. Now, thirdly, I think we need to remind our folks, although I think they're starting to get the message, that our opponents, the Republican Party, are increasingly being influenced, increasingly being dominated by people who are absolutely nuts. And by no means all Republicans, but they're becoming increasingly dominated by these people. I mean, think of some of the ideas that have been out there this campaign. Let's get rid of the 14th, repeal the 14th Amendment. Great idea. The party of Lincoln is going to repeal the 14th Amendment. Let's get rid of the Civil Rights Act. Get rid of the Civil Rights Act. That was put forward by their Senate candidate in Kentucky. Let's make abortion criminal, even for an abortion for someone who has been raped or is the victim of incest. Let's pass a law saying that zygotes are human and therefore eliminate abortion, stem cell research, and most forms of birth control. Again, I'm not making this stuff up. This is real. These are ideas that Republicans have put forward, and not just Republicans, Republicans who are running for office. And in many of these ideas, they're put forward by Republicans who are running for office who are leading or within the margin of error. Gay bashing, anti-Muslim feelings, not standing up and saying that our Muslim Americans are terrific citizens, many of whom have died fighting foreign wars protecting the United States of America. We have a Republican candidate in Ohio who dresses up in a Nazi uniform and then poses proudly in pictures. And if you think, well, he's some nut and it's extreme, understand that the Republican leader in the House, John Boehner, gave him $5,000. And when confronted with the picture, they said they're not going to ask for it back. Now imagine if you fought in World War II and your brother was killed in World War II by the German army. How would you feel to see someone wearing it, proudly wearing a Nazi uniform? It goes on and on and on. Michelle Bachmann, your neighbor, has said that there was swine flu in 1976 when Jimmy Carter was president, and there's swine flu when Barack Obama is president, and she's not sure that it's just a coincidence. And then Michelle, who is the gift that keeps on giving for us, then Michelle says something that really is scary. I mean, you can say the things that I've just said, well, they're sort of bizarre and they're never going to happen and no one takes them seriously. Wrong. On abortion, there are a lot of people who take it seriously. The candidates out there are saying we're going to eliminate Social Security and Medicare. They take it seriously, folks. But Michelle Bachmann said something that is incredibly scary. They said, she was talking to a young Republican convention. She said, when we win, the first thing we should do, the very first thing we should do, is to issue subpoenas and have investigation after investigation. And you can say, well, that's just Michelle Bachmann, but Darrell Issa from California, who's going to be chairman of the Oversight Commission if they win back the House, he agreed with her. Now, think about that. Think about how chilling that is. With all of the problems confronting this country, the very last thing we need is to have the government paralyzed by investigation after investigation, by the issuance of a subpoena. Give Barack Obama a tremendous amount of credit. When he took over, he knew the country was in tough shape, and he didn't go back, and he didn't allow investigations to be taken place that would have caused rancor and division and would have slowed up the government. Government slowed up enough on its own. But think about it. Think about it. This is scary stuff. And it's beginning to work for us. Our voters are beginning to sort of get the idea that they're offering nothing but a return to the failed policies, that they're being more and more dominated by people who are putting forth crazy ideas, that to turn even one chamber of our government over to them is a lousy idea. And I think Democrats are getting it. The momentum that you see in Iowa is taking place in Pennsylvania and in other places. And we can win this election. But in the last 16 days, I want us to do something too. And again, this is more across the board for America than just Iowa. It's time for us to start acting like Democrats. I don't know about you, and it's easy for me to say because I'm not on the ballot, but ladies and gentlemen, I've always believed this in my political career. I would rather lose fighting for something I believe in than win standing for nothing. And it's time that we got the courage to go back and say, we're Democrats. This is what we believe. To tell you the truth, I don't think we've given the American people a whole lot of reason to vote for us other than we're better than them. Think about it. We have too many candidates out there who are hoping to sneak by and somehow keep their seat by acting like Republican light. It doesn't work. People know when you stand for something. You listen to Chet Culver speak, and you know he cares about certain things. And if he's going down, and I don't think he is going down, he's going down fighting for the things he believes in, the things that are right for Iowa, the things that will make life better for people. I wonder if any of you have heard of a woman by the name of Marjorie Margolis Midzvinsky. I know you know Ed Midzvinsky used to be a congressman here in Iowa. And Marjorie and Ed's son married Chelsea Clinton. But Marjorie Margolis Midzvinsky is, to me, representative of all that's good about elective politics. She campaigned in 1992 in Montgomery County. It's a very rich suburban Philadelphia area. And she promised on the campaign trail not to vote to raise taxes. Then she took office, and the magnitude of our budget deficit and our booming national debt became clear to her. And President Clinton asked the Congress to approve raising taxes on the top 2% of Americans. And we didn't get one Republican vote for it. Sound familiar? Not one. And some of our Democrats were off the reservation. And in the House, it all came down, Marjorie refrained from voting for the longest time. It all came down to her vote. And as she voted yes, the Republicans were chanting, "Goodbye, Marjorie. Goodbye, Marjorie." She voted yes. Tax went into effect. We eliminated the deficit. We produced surpluses. We created 23.5 million new jobs. We increased the wealth of most Americans, the net worth of most Americans, dramatically. Marjorie Margolis lost the next time. But let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, she did more for America in 2 years than many congressmen do in 20 or 30, because she had the courage to do what was right. So, let's be Democrats again. Let's be proud of what we are. The stimulus worked. Don't be afraid to say it. It worked. The Congressional Budget Office says that unemployment in this country would have been 1 to 2 points higher without the stimulus. Remind people, if you make less than $250,000, if you're a family, you got an $800 tax cut from the stimulus. If you stopped 1,000 Iowans and asked them that, how many would remember that they got a tax cut from the stimulus? Probably 5 or 10. Reason? We haven't told them. We haven't said it. What are we waiting for? The stimulus created tens of thousands of well-paying construction jobs and jobs back at steel factories and asphalt factories and cement factories and aggregate factories. The stimulus worked, folks. It wasn't perfect. It didn't totally turn the economy around, but it stopped the economy from plummeting even worse. And let me talk for a minute about the Affordable Health Care Act. We Democrats, even Democrats who voted for it, act like it's a terrible piece of legislation. Well, it isn't perfect. But folks, 20 years from now, the Affordable Health Care Act will be viewed just like Social Security and Medicare are today. In the last 2 months, there have been 7 important changes that have come into effect because of the Affordable Health Care Act. And if you're a Democrat, tell me which one of these you don't like. I want you to raise your hand after I tell you. I'm going to go through them one by one. Raise your hand if you don't think it's a good idea. First, young people up to the age of 26 can be covered by their parents' insurance policy. It's mandatory for the insurance companies to give coverage to kids up to 26 on their parents' insurance policy. Anybody think that's a bad idea? I didn't think so. Children 25 years of age or younger, for the first time in history, cannot be denied if they have a pre-existing illness. So a five-year-old girl with leukemia must get health care. She isn't sentenced to die. Anybody think that's a bad idea? I didn't think so. Seniors all across this country are getting $250 checks from the Affordable Health Care Act to help them fill the donut hole in their prescription drug coverage. Anybody think that's a bad idea? I didn't think so. That we're creating high-risk pools for the very sickest Iowans and the sickest Pennsylvanians, people who may very well die if they don't get health care and couldn't get health care before because we've designed a health care system that doesn't cover the sick. But they're going into high-risk pools and getting coverage, and they have a chance to maybe survive. Anybody think that's a bad idea? That insurance companies, for the first time, are no longer allowed by law to cap the amount of money they spend on your health care in a year or in your lifetime. Anybody think that's a bad idea? Small businesses, we hear this bull that the Affordable Health Care Act is going to raise the cost of providing health care for small businesses. Not so. By 2014, when the exchanges are up, small businesses are going to be able to go in and have 7 or 8 different companies competing for their business, and that competition will lower prices. But right now, for every small business that has less than 25 employees in this country, if they are providing health care for their employees, they will get this year on their taxes a 35% federal tax credit. Let me give you an idea of the scope of that in Pennsylvania. There are 179,000 small businesses in Pennsylvania with less than 25 employees, and they employ almost 700,000 Pennsylvanians. Anybody think that's a bad idea? Well, why haven't we been talking about it? Why have we, every time they mention the Affordable Health Care Act, we cower behind the shower curtain? We just concede that it's a bad idea, or Affordable Health Care Act, Those are great things. Again, it's not perfect. We should try to change the things that need changing, but be proud of what we've done. We've ended the disgrace of America being the only developed nation that didn't have universal health care. By 2014, we'll have ended one of the most disgraceful parts of this country. And lastly, and Tom covered this in his speech, and I cannot do it as well, but he's dead right. And lastly, when we're asking voters to make up their mind and to get out and vote, remind them of who we are, what we stand for, and what we've done. Remind them that in the history of this great nation, senior citizens were given protection from the passage of Social Security and Medicare, which marked the U.S. different from any other country in the world, and it was given to them by Democrats. Remind our minority citizens that they were given rights once and for all, rights that were due them for the longest time by the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And it was given to them by Democrats. Remind the parents of our children that America stepped up and finally said, we are not going to stand by and see our children not educated well. We're not going to stand by and see our children not healthy. And children in this country were given the Head Start program and the Children's Health Insurance program, and it was given to them by Democrats. Remind everyone who's physically or mentally challenged, who has a physically or mentally challenged member of their family or friends, that, as Tom said, the Americans with Disability Act changed everything. Changed everything. From a life that was almost a prison sentence, it turned it into a life that they can enjoy the things that we all enjoy. It was manna from heaven for our disabled community, and it was given to them by Democrats. And remind the American people that they breathe cleaner air because of the Clean Air Act, that they have safer drinking water because of the Safe Drinking Water Act, that their foods and drugs that they take are safer because of the Safe Food and Drug Act, and workers have more safe working conditions because of OSHA. And all of those protections were given to the American people by Democrats. And that for working men and women who earn far too little money, who sometimes work in the toughest jobs where they stand on their feet 50, 60 hours a week, every time the minimum wage was raised in this country, every time the minimum wage was raised in this country, it was done by Democrats. And we were, when President Bush was president and refused to sign an increase in the minimum wage, we fought hard to get through the Republican legislature an increase in the Pennsylvania minimum wage from about $5.15 to $7.15. And when I signed that bill, and I signed it in a church, and there must have been 1,000 people in the church, I signed that bill, Edward G. Rendell. And when the last L was written on that bill, 430,000 Pennsylvanians got a $4,000 raise. Now, for many of us, a $4,000 raise doesn't make a whole lot of difference in the quality of our lives. But these people were making $10,400. A $4,000 raise for them was like manna from heaven. A $4,000 raise from them gave them the ability to take care of their children. That's what we're about. And the Affordable Health Care Act is just another step in the right direction. All these things given to the United States of America by Democrats. Almost all of them, the majority of Republicans opposed us, tried to stop us, tried to keep the American people from enjoying things that citizens in most countries never even get to dream of. We did those things, folks. And I want you to remind them of one other thing. Remind them that we're the party of inclusion. We're the party that believes America can be proud, strong, and free. But to be proud, strong, and free, it has to be proud, strong, and free for all of us, not some of us. So, with 16 days to go, let's become Democrats again. Let's be proud of who we are, what we've done. Let's tell the people we're the best vehicle. For ordinary working people, it's not even close. We're the best hope and in some ways the only hope they have to continue to progress. We're the only hope to protect the most vulnerable people in this country. We're the only hope to create opportunity for every citizen. That's what we've always been. It's our tradition. It's what FDR was about. It's what Adlai Stevenson fought for. It was what Jack Kennedy was striving for. We have every reason to be proud. We have every reason to be aggressive. We have every reason to go out there and kick their butts. Thank you all very, very much.